Christ. Raven cried out. Raven, whose voice she had never heard. Raven, who once, when they were serving together in the temple, had caught a lamp about to overflow, and scalded with the burning oil, had sat smothering her screams with her two hands while her burns were bandaged, that she might not break the vow which had given her voice to the goddess. She would always bear the scars. Once, looking at her, Morgaine had thought, "The vow I made was a little thing next to that, and yet I came so near to breaking it for a dark and sweet-voiced man." And now, Raven, in the moonless night, screamed aloud, a high eldritch crying, like a woman in childbed. 3 times the shrill cry trembled over the tor, and Morgaine shivered again, knowing that even the priests on the other island that lay corresponding to their own must waken in their solitary cells and cross themselves, hearing that haunted cry that rang between the worlds. After the cry, silence. A silence which seemed to Morgaine filled with breathing, with held breath even, from the unseen initiates who now surrounded the dreadful solitude inhabited only by the 3 motionless priestesses. Then, gasping and choking as if her voice were long disabled from the silence, Raven cried out, "Ah, 7 times the wheel with 13 spokes, has turned about in the sky. 7 times the mother has given birth to her dark son." Again the silence, deepening in contrast, except for the choking gasps of the entranced prophetess. She cried out, "Ah, I burn, it is time," and lapsed again into the clotted silence, pregnant with terror. They run in the spring rutting. They run, they fight, they choose their king. Oh, the blood! And the greatest of them all, he runs. And there is blood on the antlers of his pride. Again the silence lengthened, and Morgaine, seeing in the darkness behind her eyelids the spring running of the deer, saw again what she had seen in a half-forgotten glimpse in the silver ball. A man among the deer, struggling, fighting. "It is the child of the goddess. He runs, he runs. The horned one must die, and the horned one must be crowned. The virgin huntress must call the king to her. She must lay down her maidenhood to the god. Ah, the old sacrifice, the old sacrifice. I burn, I burn." And the words began to choke over one another and die in a long sobbing scream. Behind her, through her closed eyes, Morgaine saw Raven fall senseless to the ground and lie there, gasping, her gasps the only sound in the deepening silence. Somewhere an owl called, once, twice, 3 times. Out of the darkness priestesses came, silent and dark, blue gleams on their brow. They lifted Raven tenderly and bore her away. They lifted Morgaine too, and she felt her throbbing head tenderly held to a woman's breast as they carried her away. Then she knew no more. Three days later, when she had recovered her strength somewhat, Vivian sent for her. Morgaine rose and tried to dress herself, but she was still weak, and accepted the help of one of the young priestesses, grateful that the girl was under silence and didn't speak to her. The long fasting, the terrible sickness brought on by the ritual herbs, the strung tension of the ritual still gripped at her body. She had eaten a little soup the night before, and some bread soaked in milk this morning, but she still felt sick and empty after the long strain, and her head throbbed, and her moon-dark bleeding had seized her with a violence never felt before. This, too, she knew, might be the after-effect of the sacred herbs. Sick and incurious, she wished that Vivian had left her to recover in peace. But she did Vivian's will, as she would have done that of the goddess, had the goddess leaned down from heaven and spoken a wish aloud. When she was dressed, and had braided her hair, and wound it with a deerskin thong, and painted the blue crescent on her forehead with fresh blue dye, she went along the trail to the house where the high priestess lived. As was now her privilege, she entered without knocking or announcing her presence. Somehow, in this house she always visualized Vivian waiting for her, seated in the throne-like chair as if she were the goddess on her dark throne. But today Vivian was moving about at the back of the room, and the fire was not lighted but dark and cold. Vivian wore her simple robe of undyed wool with a hood tied over her hair, and for the first time it came sharply on Morgaine that Vivian was priestess, not now of the maiden or of the mother, but of the ancient wise woman, who was also the old death crone. Her face looked lined and haggard, and Morgaine thought, "Of course, if the rites made Raven ill and myself, and we are both young and strong, what must it have done to Vivian, who has grown old in the service of her whom we serve?" Then Vivian turned and smiled at her, a loving smile, and Morgaine felt again the old surge of love and tenderness. But, as was fitting a younger priestess in the presence of the lady, she waited for Vivian to speak first. Vivian gestured to her to sit. "Have you recovered, child?" Morgaine let herself drop to the bench and knew that even from the short walk she was exhausted. She shook her head. "I know," Vivian said. "Sometimes when they do not know how you will react, they give you too much. Next time, do not take all they give you. Judge how much you can take. Enough to give you the sight, but not enough to make you so very ill. You have that right now. You have reached a stage where obedience may be tempered with your own judgment." For some reason, those words rang again and again in Morgaine's mind. Tempered with your own judgment. Tempered with your own judgment. She thought, "I am still sick from the drugs they gave me," and shook her head, impatient to clear away the sound and listen to Vivian. "How much did you understand of Raven's prophecy?" "Very little," Morgaine confessed. "It was mysterious to me. I'm not sure why I was there." "Partly," Vivian said, "to lend your strength to her. She is not strong. She is still abed, and I am concerned about her. She knows how much of the herb she can take, yet even that little seemed to be too much. She vomited blood, and is passing more, but she will not die." Morgaine put out a hand to steady herself. She felt hollow, and a sudden wave of sickness passed over her again, leaving her pale and giddy. Without excuse, she stood up, staggered outside, and vomited, bringing up the bread and milk she had swallowed that morning. She heard Vivian speak her name, and when she had done and stood clutching the door-frame, retching, she found one of the young attendant priestesses there with a cloth to wipe her face. It was wet and smelled faintly of sweet herbs. Vivian steadied her step as she came back inside, then handed her a small cup. "Sip it slowly," she said. It burned her tongue, and for a moment exaggerated the feeling of sickness. It was the strong spirit distilled by the northern tribes. Water of life, they called it. She had tasted it only once or twice. But when it was down, she felt a strong warmth spreading out from her empty stomach, and after a few minutes she felt better, steadier, almost euphoric. "A little more," Vivian said. "It will strengthen your heart. Now, do you feel better?" Morgaine nodded.
Thank you.
Tonight you will be able to eat, said Vivian. And in Morgaine's strange state, it sounded like a command, as if Vivian could command her very stomach to behave itself.
So, let us talk of Raven's prophecy. In the ancient days, long before the wisdom and the religion of the Druids came here from the sunken temples in the western continent, the fairy people, of whom we are both born, you and I, my Morgaine, lived here on the shores of the inland sea. And before they learned how to plant the barley and reap it again, they lived by gathering the fruits of the land and by hunting the deer. And in those days there was no king among them, but only a queen who was their mother, though they had not yet learned to think of her as the goddess. And since they lived by hunting, their queen and priestess learned to call the deer to her, and ask of their spirits that they sacrifice themselves and die for the life of the tribe. But sacrifice must be given for sacrifice. The deer died for the tribe, and one of the tribe must in turn die for the life of the deer, or at least take the chance that the deer could, if they chose, take his life in exchange for their own. So the balance was kept. Do you understand this, my darling?
Morgaine heard the unaccustomed endearment, and wondered dimly in her sick and drunken state, Is she telling me that I am to be the sacrifice? Is my life chosen for the tribe? It doesn't matter. I'm given to the goddess for life or for death. I understand, Mother. At least I think I do.
So the mother of the tribe chose every year her consort. And since he had agreed to give his life for the tribe gave him of their lives. Even if little children at the breast starved, he always had abundance, and all the women of the tribe were his to lie with, so that he, the strongest and best, might sire their children. Besides, the mother of the tribe was often old, past childbearing, and so he must have the choice of the young maidens too, and no man of the tribe would interfere with what he wanted. And then, when the year was past, every year in those times, he would put on the antlers of the deer, and wear a robe of untanned deerskin, so that the deer would think him one of their own, and he would run with the herd as the mother huntress put the spell upon them to run. But by this time, the herd had chosen their king stag, and sometimes the king stag would smell a stranger and turn on him, and then the horned one would die.
Morgaine felt again the ice down her spine that she had felt when, on the tor, this ritual had been enacted before her eyes. The year's king is to die for the life of his people. Was the drug still working in her mind that she could see it all so clearly?
Well, time has moved on, Morgaine, Vivian told her quietly. And now those old rites are no longer needed, for the barley grows, and the sacrifice is bloodless. Only in times of great peril does the tribe demand such a leader. And Raven has foreseen that this is a time of such peril. So once again there will be a testing of one who runs the risk of death for his chosen people, so that they will follow him unto death. You have heard me speak of the great marriage.
Morgaine nodded. Of this, Lancelot had been born.
The tribes of the fairy folk and all the tribes of the north have been given a great leader, and the chosen one will be tested by the ancient rite. And if he survives the testing, which will to some extent depend on the strength with which the maiden huntress can enchant the deer, then he will become the horned one, the king stag, consort of the virgin huntress, crowned with the antlers of the god. Morgaine, I told you years ago that your maidenhood belongs to the goddess. Now she calls for it in sacrifice to the horned god. You are to be the virgin huntress, and the bride of the horned one. You have been chosen for this service.
It was very still in the room, as if they stood again in the centre of the ringstones in ritual. Morgaine dared not break the silence. At last, knowing that Vivian was waiting for some word of consent, what had the words been so long ago?
It is too heavy a burden to be borne unconsenting. She bowed her head.
My body and my soul belong to her, to do with as she will, she whispered.
And your will is her will, mother. Let it be so.
Chapter 15. Since she had come there, Morgaine had left Avalon only two or three times, and then only for short journeys into the countryside at the edges of the summer sea, so that she could become aware of the nearby sights which retained, despite disuse, their old power. Time and place were now none of her concern. She had been taken from the island at dawn, in silence, cloaked and veiled, so that no unpriestly eye might see the consecrated one, and carried in a closed litter so that not even the sun might shine on her face. In less than a day's journeying from the enclosure of the sacred island, she had lost all awareness of time and space and direction, lost in meditation, dimly aware of the beginning of the magical trance. There had been times when she had fought against the onset of the ecstatic state. Now she welcomed it, opening her mind full to the goddess, inwardly imploring the goddess to come into herself, the instrument, and possess her, body and soul, so that she might act in all things as the goddess herself. Nightfall. A moon nearly at full came dimly between the curtains of the litter. When the runners stopped, she felt it bathing her in cold light like the kiss of the goddess, and felt faint with the beginnings of ecstasy. She didn't know where she was, nor did she care. She went where they led her, passive, blinded, tranced, knowing only that she went to meet her destiny. She was inside a house. Then she was put into the hands of a strange woman, who brought her bread and honey, which Morgaine didn't touch. She would not break her fast again until she did so with the ritual meal, and water, which she drank thirstily. There was a bed, so placed that the moon fell upon her. The strange woman moved to draw the wooden shutters closed, and Morgaine stopped her with an imperious gesture. She lay much of the night tranced, feeling the moonlight like a visible touch. At last she slept, but fitfully, wandering in and out of sleep like an uneasy traveller, strange images flickering in her mind. Her mother bending over the fair hair of the intruder Gwydion, her white breasts and coppery hair somehow forbidding instead of welcoming. Vivian? Only somehow she was a sacrificial beast, and the Lady of Avalon was leading her somewhere on the end of a rope. And she heard herself say fretfully, "You needn't pull. I'm coming." Raven soundlessly screaming. A great horn figure, half man, half animal, suddenly thrusting aside a curtain and striding into her room. She woke and half sat up. But there was no one there, only the moonlight and the stranger woman sleeping quietly at her side. Quickly she lay down again and slept, this time dreamlessly and deep. About an hour before dawn they awakened her. Now, in contrast to the tranced unawareness of the previous day, she was wide awake and sharply aware of everything. The cold fresh air, the mists stained with pink where soon the sun would rise, the strong smell of the little dark women in their garments of badly tanned skins. Everything was clean-edged and brilliantly coloured, as if fresh this moment from the hand of the goddess. The dark women whispered among themselves, not presuming to disturb the strange priestess. She heard them, but she knew only a few words of their language. After a time, the eldest of them, the one who had welcomed her and led her inside on the previous night, and whose bed she had shared, came to Morgaine and brought her fresh water. Morgaine bowed to thank her, a salute, priestess to priestess, then wondered why. The woman was old. Her hair, long and tangled, and fastened with a clasp of bone, was almost all white, and her dark skin bore faded blue stains. Her garment was of the same imperfectly dyed skin of the others, but over it she wore a cloak of deerskin, the hair still clinging to it, painted with magical symbols, and about her neck were two necklaces, one of beautiful amber beads. Vivian herself owned none finer, and the other of bits of horn alternating with exquisitely chased gold bars. She carried herself with the authority of Vivian herself, and Morgaine knew that this was the tribal mother and priestess of the people. With her own hands, the woman began to prepare Morgaine for the ritual. She stripped her naked and painted the soles of her feet and the palms of her hands with blue dye, and renewed the crescent moon on her brow. On her breast and belly she outlined the full moon, and just above the dark patch of Morgaine's body hair she painted the dark moon. Briefly, almost perfunctorily, she parted the girl's legs and probed a little. Morgaine, beyond embarrassment, knew why she was searching. For this rite, the priestess must be a virgin. But the tribal priestess would find nothing wrong. Morgaine was untouched, but she felt a sudden, half-pleasurable moment of fear, and at the same moment she was conscious that she was almost fiercely hungry. Well, she was trained to ignore hunger, and after a time the hunger left her. The sun was rising as they let her outdoors, robed in a cloak like the old woman's, with the magical signs painted on it, the moon, the antlers of the deer. She was aware of the stiff astringency of her painted body, and some part of her mind, very far away, stared with amazement and a moment's contempt at these symbols of a mystery far older than the druidic wisdom in which she had been so carefully schooled. That was momentary, and vanished at once. The belief of generations, ancient past knowing, invested this rite with its own power and holiness. She saw the round stone house behind her. Across from her was another, and they were leading forth a young man. She couldn't see him clearly. The rising sun was in her eyes, and she could see only that he was tall, with a shock of fair hair, and strongly built. He is not one of their own people, then. But it was not for her to question. The men of the tribe, and especially an old man, with the gnarled, swollen muscles of a smith, blackened like his own forge, were painting the youth's body from head to foot with the blue woad, covering him with a cloak of untanned raw skins, smearing his body with the deer fat. On his head they fixed antlers. At a low word of command, he swung his head to make certain they couldn't be dislodged, no matter how he moved. Morgaine looked up to see the proud swing of that young head, and suddenly she felt a ripple of awareness run down her body, cramping her calves, running into the secret parts of her body. This is the Horned One. This is the god. This is the consort of the Virgin Huntress. They wound her hair in a garland of crimson berries and crowned her with the first of the spring flowers. The precious necklace of gold and bone was reverently taken from the neck of the mother of the tribe and placed around her own. She felt its weight like the very weight of magic. Her eyes were dazzled with the rising sun. They placed something in her hand, a drum, taut skin stretched over a hooped frame. As if it came from somewhere else, she heard her own hand strike it. They stood on a hillside, overlooking a valley filled to the brim with thick forest, empty and silent. But within it she could sense the life in the forest, the deer moving on silent, slender feet, the animals climbing in the trees, and the birds nesting, darting, moving, a surge with the life of the first running tide of the full moon of spring. She turned for a moment and looked behind on the hillside. Above them, carved white in the chalk, was a monstrous figure, human or animal she couldn't tell. Her eyes were blurred. Was it a running deer? Or was it a striding man, phallus erect and filled with the spring tide, too? She couldn't see the young man at her side, only the surge of the life in him. There was a solemn, waiting hush all over the hillside. Time ceased, was again transparent, something in which she moved, bathed, stepped freely. The drum was in the old crone's hands again, but she had no awareness of having given it over to her. Her eyes were dazed with sun as she felt the god's head between her hands, blessing him. Something in the face... Of course! Before these hills were raised, she had known this face, this man, her consort, from before the beginning of the world. She didn't hear her own ritual words, only the surge of force behind them. Go forth and conquer. Run with the deer, swift and strong as the very tides of the spring. For ever blessed be the feet that brought you here. She wasn't conscious of speech, only of the power of her own hands blessing, of the force that streamed out of her body, through her body, as if the very strength of the sun poured through her and into the man before her. Now the power of the winter is broken, and the new life of the spring shall go with you and bring you to victory. Life of the goddess, life of the world, blood of the earth, our mother, shed for her people. She raised her hands, casting the blessing on the forest, on the earth, feeling the surges of power rushing through her hands like visible light. The young man's body was glowing like her own in the sunlight. Around them none dared speak, until, pulling her hands back with a rush, she felt the surge of power flung over them all, releasing the chant that rose around them. She couldn't hear the words, only the thrum of power within them. Life surges in the spring, the deer run in the forest, and our life runs with them. The king stag of the world shall bring them down. The king stag, the horned one, blessed by the mother, shall triumph. She was drawn to the last notch of tension, a strung bow pregnant with the arrow of power that must be sped. She touched the horned one, releasing the power, and as if it sped through them all, they were off, running like the wind down the hillside, racing as if the very spring tides bore them. Behind them, feeling the power leave her, Morgaine crumpled and lay silent on the earth, feeling its damp chill strike up through her body. But she was unaware, tranced in the sight. She lay as if lifeless, but a part of her went with them, raced with them, speeding down the hillside, racing with the men of the tribe, flooding after the horned one. Barking cries, as if they were hounds, sped after them, and a part of her knew that the women were crying out, speeding on the chase. Higher in the sky the sun rose, the great wheel of life spinning in the heavens, fruitlessly speeding after her divine consort, the dark sun. The life of the earth, the pounding tides of the spring, flooded and pounded in the hearts of the running men. Then, as the ebb followed the flow, from the sunlit hillside, the darkness of forest closed over them and swallowed them. And from running they moved swiftly on noiseless feet, imitating the delicate step of the deer. They were the deer, following the antlers of their horned one, wearing the cloaks which held the deer spellbound, and the necklaces signifying life as endless chain. Live, and feed, and bear, and die, and be eaten in turn to feed the children of the mother. Hold thy children, mother. Thy king stag must die to feed the life of her dark son.
Darkness, the inner life of the forest closing around them.
Silence. The silence of the deer.
Morgaine, aware now of the forest as life and the deer as the heart of the forest, cast her power and her blessing through and over the forest. A part of her lay on the sunlit hillside, tranced, exhausted, letting the life of the sun flood through her, body and blood and inner being, and a part of her ran with deer and men until both were one, blending into one. The surges of life that were the quiet deer in their thicket, the little does, smooth and slender, the life racing in them as it raced in her body, the surges of life that were the men, slipping silent and intent through the shadows. Somewhere in the forest she felt the king stag fling up his head, sniffing the wind, aware for the scent of an enemy, one of his own, one of the alien tribe of life. She didn't know whether it was the four-footed king stag or the two-legged one she had blessed. They were one in the life of the Mother Earth, and their lot was in the hands of the goddess. Antlers answered the toss of antlers, the sniffing breath taking in the life of the forest, searching it for alien, for prey, for predator, for rival where there could be none. Ah, goddess! They were off, crashing through the underbrush, men fleet behind them, only more silent. Running, running, run till the heart throbs like bursting in the chest. Run till the life of the body overwhelms all knowledge and thought. Fleet, searching and being sought. Run with the deer who flee and the men who pursue. Run with the spinning life of the great sun and the surge of the spring tides. Run with the flow of life. Lying motionless, her face pressed into the earth and the flooding sun burning her back, time crawling and racing by turns, Morgaine began to see, and from very far off it seemed that she had seen this before, in vision, sometime, somewhere, a very long time ago. The tall, sinewy youth gripping his knife, falling, falling among the deer, among the slashing hooves. She knew she screamed aloud, and simultaneously knew that her cry had rung everywhere, so that even the king stag paused in mid-charge, appalled, hearing the shriek. There was a moment when everything stopped, and in that terrible moment of silence she saw that he scrambled to his feet, panting, charging with his head down, swinging his antlers, locking head-on as he swayed and struggled, wrestling the deer with his strong hands and young body. A knife slashed upward. Blood spilled on the earth, and he was bleeding too, the horned one, blood on his hands, blood from a long slash on his side, the blood spilling on the earth, sacrifice spilled to the mother that life should feed on her blood. And then the blood of the king stag went over him in a gush as his blade found the heart, and the men around him rushed in with their spears. She saw him carried back, covered in the blood of his twin and rival, the king stag. All around him the little dark men were slashing, putting the raw, warm hide over his shoulders. Back they came in triumph, fires rising in the gathering dusk. And when the women lifted Morgaine, she saw, without surprise, that the sun was setting, and she staggered as if she too had run all day with the hunt and the deer. They crowned her again with the crimson of triumph. The horned one was brought before her, bleeding, and she blessed him and marked his forehead with the blood of the deer. The head was taken with the antlers which would bring down the next king stag. The antlers which the horned one had worn this day, broken and splintered, were cast into the fire.
Soon there was a smell of burning flesh, and she wondered if it was the flesh of man or stag.
They seated them side by side and brought the first meats to them, dripping still with blood and the fat juices. Morgaine felt her head swimming, the rich taste of the meat overpowering her after her long fast. She was afraid for a moment that she would be sick again. Next to her, he was eating hungrily, and she noticed by firelight that he had fine, strong hands. She blinked, seeing in a strange moment of doubled vision that serpents twined around them. Then they were gone again. All around them the men and women of the tribe were sharing in the ritual feast, the hymn of triumph sung in an old language Morgaine could only half understand. He has triumphed, he has slain. The blood of our mother is shed upon the earth, the blood of the god is spilled upon the earth, and he shall rise and reign for ever. He has triumphed, he shall triumph for ever until the end of the world. The old priestess, who had painted and decked her this morning, held a silver cup to her lips. She felt the strong liquor sting her throat and burn all the way down. Fire, with a strong taste of honey behind it. Already she was drunk with the blood of the meat. She had tasted meat only a few times in the last 7 years. Her head was swimming as they bore her away, stripped her, and bedecked her naked body with more paint and garlands, marking her nipples and brow with the blood of the slain deer. The goddess receives her consort, and she will slay him again at the end of time. She shall give birth to her dark son, who will bring the king stag down. A little girl, painted blue from head to foot, and bearing a broad dish, ran across the ploughed field, scattering dark drops as she ran, and Morgaine heard the great cry that went up behind her. The fields are blessed. Give us food, O our mother. And for an instant, some small part of Morgaine, dizzy and drunk, and only half in her body at all, remarked coldly that she certainly must be mad. She, a civilized and educated woman, princess and priestess and kin to the royal line of Avalon, druid taught, here, painted like a savage and smelling of freshly shed blood, enduring this barbarian mummery. Then it was all gone again, as the full moon, serene and proud, rose over the clouds that had barriered it from sight. Bathed naked in the moonlight, Morgaine felt the light of the goddess streaming over, through her. She was Morgaine no more. She was nameless, priestess and maiden and mother. They strung a garland of crimson berries about her loins. The crude symbolism struck her with sudden fear, and she felt the full weight of virginity pouring and flooding through her like the spring tide. A torch flared in her eyes, and they led her into darkness, echoing silences above and beyond her, a cave. All round her, on the walls, she could see the sacred symbols painted there from the beginning of time, the stag and antlers, the man with the horns on his brow, the swollen belly and full breasts of she who gives life. The priestess laid Morgaine on the couch of deerskins. For a moment she felt cold and frightened, and she shivered, and the old woman's brow wrinkled in compassion. She drew Morgaine into her arms and kissed her on the lips, and Morgaine clung for a moment to the old woman, hugging her in sudden terror, as if the woman's sheltering arms were her mother's own. Then the woman smiled at her and kissed her again, and touched her breasts in blessing, and went away. She lay there, feeling the life of the earth around her. She seemed to expand, to fill all the cave. The little scribbled drawings were painted on her breasts and her belly, and above her the great chalk figure, man or deer, strode with erect phallus.
the invisible moon outside the cave, flooding her body with light as the goddess surged inside her, body and soul. She stretched out her arms, and at her command she knew that outside the cave, in the light of the fecundating fires, man and woman, drawn one to the other by the pulsating surges of life, came together. The little blue-painted girl who had borne the fertilizing blood was drawn down into the arms of a sinewy old hunter, and Morgaine saw her briefly struggle and cry out, go down under his body, her legs opening to the irresistible force of nature in them. She saw without sight, her eyes closed against the glare of the torch, hearing the cries. Now he was in the door of the cave, the antlers gone from his brow, his hair streaked, his body smeared blue and stained with blood, white skin like the white chalk of the body of the huge figure above the cave. The horned one, the consort. He moved dizzily, too, naked, except for a garland like her own about his loins, and she could see the erect life surging in him like that of the chalk figure. He knelt by her side, and by the torchlight, dazzled, she could see that he was no more than a boy, not one of the little dark people, but tall and fair. Why have they chosen a king who is not one of their own? The thought darted across her mind like a moonbeam and was gone. She wasn't thinking at all. Now it is the time for the goddess to welcome the horned one. He was kneeling at the edge of the deerskin couch, swaying, blinking by the light of the torch. She reached up to him, gripped his hands, drew him down to her, feeling the soft warmth and weight of his body. She had to guide him. I am the great mother who knows all things, who is maiden and mother and all wise, guiding the virgin and her consort. Dazed, terrified, exalted, only half-conscious, she felt the life-force take them both, moving her body without volition, moving him too, guiding him fiercely into her, till they were both moving without knowledge of what force gripped them. She heard herself crying out as if from a great distance, heard his voice high and shaken in the silence, never knowing what either of them cried out at that moment. The torch guttered and went out in the darkness as all the fierce fury of his young life burst and spurted into her womb. He moaned and fell forward across her, lifeless except for his hoarse breathing. She eased him away, cradling his weight in her arms, holding him with weary warmth. She felt him kiss her naked breast. Then slowly, tiredly, his breathing quieted to normal, and after a moment she knew that he slept in her arms. She kissed his hair and his soft cheek with a wild tenderness, and then she too slept. When she woke, the night was far advanced. Moonlight had crept into the cave. She was utterly weary, her whole body aching, and she felt between her legs and knew that she was bleeding. She flung her damp hair back, looking down by the moonlight at the sprawled, pale body still sleeping the sleep of long exhaustion beside her. He was tall and strong and beautiful, though by moonlight she couldn't see his features clearly, and the magical sight had deserted her. Now there was only the moon's light and brilliance, no longer the compelling face of the goddess. She was Morgaine again, not the shadow of the Great Mother. She was herself again, clear in her mind about what had happened. She thought for a moment of Lancelot, whom she had loved, and to whom she had hungered to give this gift. Now it had come, not to a lover, but to a faceless stranger. No, she mustn't think like that. She wasn't a woman. She was a priestess, and she had given the force of the Virgin to the Horned One, as had been ordained for her fate before the walls of the world were laid. She had accepted her destiny as a priestess of Avalon must do, and she sensed that something of shattering importance had happened here in the night past. She was cold and lay down, covering herself with the deerskin coverlet. She wrinkled her nose a little at its rankness. They had strewn it with sweet herbs, so at least there wouldn't be fleas. Experienced at judging the tides, she guessed it was about an hour before sunrise. At her side the boy felt her stir and sat up sleepily.
"Where are we?" he asked.
"Oh, yes, I remember, in the cave."
"Why, it's already getting light."
He smiled and reached for her. She let him pull her down and kiss her, wrapping her in strong arms.
"Last night you were the goddess," he murmured, "but I wake and I find you are a woman."
She laughed softly. "And you are not the god, but a man."
"I think I've had enough of being a god. And besides, it seems to me that it is presumptuous for a man of flesh and blood," he said, holding her against him. "I am content to be no more than a man."
She said, "Perhaps there is a time to be goddess and god, and a time to be no more than flesh and blood."
"I was afraid of you last night," he confessed. "I thought you the goddess, all larger than life."
"And you are such a little thing." Suddenly he blinked and said, "Why, you speak my language. I hadn't noticed."
"You aren't one of this tribe, then?"
"I am a priestess from the Holy Isle."
"And the priestess is a woman," he said, his hands gently exploring her breasts, which stirred into sudden life and hunger at his touch. "Do you think the goddess will be angry with me if I like the woman better?"
She laughed and said, "The goddess is wise in the ways of men."
"And is her priestess?"
Suddenly she felt shy. "No. I've never known a man before this," she said. "And it wasn't I, but the goddess." He said in the dimness, drawing her close to him,
"Since the god and the goddess have known pleasure, should not the man and the woman know it also?"
His hands were growing bolder, and she pulled him down to her. "Seems only fitting," she said. This time, in full awareness, she could savour it, the softness and the hardness, the strong young hands, and the surprising gentleness behind his bold approach. She laughed in delight at the unexpected pleasure, fully open to him, sensing his enjoyment as her own. She had never been so happy in her life. Spent, they lay, limbs twined, caressing each other in a pleasant fatigue. At last, in the growing light, he sighed.
"They will be coming for me soon," he said. "And there is much more of this. I'm to be taken somewhere and given a sword and many other things."
He sat up and smiled at her.
"And I would like to wash and have clothes befitting a civilized man and free myself of all this blood and blue dye."
How everything passes.
"Last night I didn't even know I was all smeared with blood.
Look,
you too are covered with the stag's blood where I lay on you."
"I think when they come for me they will bathe me and give me fresh garments," she said. "And you too, in a running stream." He sighed with a gentle boyish melancholy. His voice was breaking, an uncertain baritone. How could he be so young, this young giant who had fought the king's stag and killed him with his flint knife?
"I don't suppose I will ever meet you again," he said, "for you are a priestess and dedicated to the goddess. But I want to say this to you," and he leaned down and kissed her between her breasts. "You were the very first. No matter how many women I may have, for all my life, I will always remember you and love you and bless you. I promise you that."
There were tears on his cheek. Morgaine reached for her garment and tenderly dried the tears, cradling his head against her. At the gesture, he seemed to stop breathing.
"Your voice," he whispered.
"And what you just did. Why do I seem to know you? Is it because you are the goddess, and in her all women are the same?"
"No."
He stiffened, raised himself, took her face between his hands. In the growing light, she saw the boyish features strengthened into the lines of a man. Still only half aware of why she seemed to know him, she heard his hoarse cry.
"Morgaine. You are Morgaine. Morgaine, my sister. Oh, God, Mary Virgin, what have we done?"
She put her hands up to her eyes slowly.
"My brother," she whispered.
"Oh, goddess, brother, Gwydion."
"Arthur," he muttered.
She held him tight, and after a moment he sobbed, still holding her. "No wonder it seemed to me that I have known you since before the world was made," he said, weeping.
"I have always loved you, and this, oh, God, what have we done?"
"Don't cry," she said helplessly. "Don't cry. We are in the hands of her who brought us here. It doesn't matter. We are not brother and sister here. We are man and woman before the goddess. No more."
"And I never knew you again.
My brother, my baby, the one who lay on my breast like a little child.
Morgaine, Morgaine.
I told you to take care of the baby as she went away and left us." And he cried himself to sleep in my arms. And I didn't know.
"It's all right," she said, rocking him.
"Don't cry, my brother, my beloved, my little one. Don't cry. It's all right." But even as she soothed him, despair beat at her.
"Why did you do this to us, great mother, lady, why?"
And she didn't know whether she was calling to Vivian or to the goddess. Chapter 16. All the long road to Avalon, Morgaine lay in her litter, her head throbbing, and that question beating in her mind. Why? She was exhausted after the 3 days of fasting and the long day of ritual. She knew vaguely that the night's feasting and lovemaking had been intended to release that force, and they would have done so, returning her to normal, except for the morning's shock. She knew herself well enough to know that when the shock and exhaustion wore off, they would be followed by rage, and she wished that she could reach Vivian before the rage exploded, while she could still maintain some semblance of calm. They took the lake route this time, and she was allowed, at her own earnest request, to walk a part of the way. She was no longer the ritually shielded maiden of the ceremony, but only one of the priestess attendants of the Lady of the Lake. Returning with the barge across the lake, she was asked to summon the mists for the making of the gateway to Avalon. She rose to do so, almost perfunctorily, so much had she come to take this mystery for granted as a part of her life. Yet, as she raised her arms for the summoning, she had a sudden paralyzing moment of doubt. The change within her seemed so great, did she still retain the force to make the gateway? So great was her rebellion that for an instant she hesitated, and the men in the boat looked at her in polite concern. She felt pierced by their eyes, and by a moment of intense shame, as if all that had befallen her the night before must somehow be printed on her face in the language of lust. The sound of church bells rang out quietly over the lake, and suddenly Morgaine was back in childhood, listening to Father Columba speaking earnestly of chastity as the greatest approach to the holiness of Mary, Mother of God, who, by miracle, had borne her son without even a momentary stain of the world's sin. Even at that time, Morgaine had thought, "What great nonsense that is, How could any woman bear a child without knowing a man? But at the sound of the holy bells, something within her seemed to crumple and fold itself away, and she felt tears suddenly streaming down her face.
Lady, are you ill?
She shook her head, saying firmly, No, I felt faint for a moment. She drew a deep breath. Arthur wasn't in the boat. No, of course not. He had been taken by Merlin on the hidden way. The goddess is one, Mary the Virgin, the Great Mother, the Huntress, and I have a part in her greatness. She made a banishing gesture and raised her arms again, swiftly drawing down the curtain of the mist through which they would reach Avalon. Night was falling, but although Morgaine was hungry and weary, she made her way at once toward the lady's house. But at the door, a priestess stopped her when she would have entered.
The lady can see no one at present.
Nonsense, Morgaine said, feeling the beginnings of anger through the merciful numbness, and hoping it would hold until she had confronted Vivian. I am her kinswoman. Ask if I may come to her. The priestess went away and quickly returned, saying,
The lady said, Tell Morgaine to go at once to the House of Maidens, and I will speak to her when the proper time comes.
For a moment, anger surged in Morgaine so great that she came near to shoving the woman out of the way and forcing herself into Vivian's house. But awe still held her. She didn't know what the penalty would be for a priestess who defied her sworn obedience, but through her flooding anger, a small, cold, rational voice told her that she really didn't want to find out this way. She drew a long breath, composing her face into the proper demeanour for a priestess, bowed obediently, and went away. The tears she had forced back, hearing church bells on the lake, were beginning to break through, and for a moment she wished wearily that she could let them come. Now, at long last, alone in the House of Maidens, in her own quiet room, she could weep if she must, but the tears wouldn't come. Only bafflement and pain and the anger which she had no way to express. It was as if her entire body and soul were locked into one great knot of anguish. It was 10 days before Vivian sent for her. The full moon that had shone on the triumph of the Horned One had dwindled in the sky to a sickly, dying splinter. By the time one of the young priestesses brought a message that Vivian required her presence, Morgaine had given way to smouldering anger. She has played upon me as I would play upon the harp. The words rang so in her mind that at first, hearing harp music from inside Vivian's dwelling, she thought it the echo of her own bitter thoughts. Then she thought that Vivian was playing. But in the year she had been in Avalon, she had learned much of music, and she knew the sound of Vivian's harp. The older woman was, at best, an indifferent player. She listened now, wondering in spite of herself who the musician was. Taliesin? Before he was the Merlin, she knew he had been the greatest of bards, renowned throughout the length of Britain. She had heard him play often enough on the great feast days, and for the most solemn of rituals. But now his hands were old. Their skill was not diminished, but even at his best he had never made such sounds as these. This was a new harper, one she knew she had never heard before. And she knew, even before she saw it, that this was a larger harp than even Taliesin played. And the strange musician's fingers spoke to the strings, as if he had enchanted them. Vivian had once told her some old tale from a far-off country, a tale of a bard whose strings had made the ringstones circle in their own dance, and the trees drop their leaves in mourning. And when he went down into the country of the dead, the stern judges there relented and let his beloved dead go forth. Morgaine stood motionless outside the door, as everything that was in her faded into the music. Suddenly she felt that all the weeping she had held back in the 10 days past might come upon her again.